What happens when the greatest epic poem in English literature begins not in heaven, but in hell? John Milton, blind and politically defeated after the monarchy's restoration, dictated a work in 1667 that would transform a simple biblical tale into literature's most psychologically complex exploration of rebellion, temptation, and redemption. Paradise Lost doesn't just retell Adam and Eve's fall, it dares to enter Satan's mind, making him so magnificently articulate that William Blake later claimed Milton was of the devil's party without knowing it. From rock legends like Bono to fantasy authors like Philip Pullman, creators across centuries have found themselves haunted by Milton's cosmic vision. This isn't your Sunday school story. It's a sweeping drama that forces us to confront uncomfortable questions. Can rebellion be heroic? Is obedience always virtuous? And what does it really mean to be free? Satan awakens on a burning lake, defeated but defiant. Better to reign in hell than serve in heaven. Rallying his fallen angels, scattered thick as autumnal leaves, he transforms catastrophic defeat into twisted victory. His shield stretches vast as the moon. His spear towers taller than Norway's tallest pine. This is no cartoon devil, but a figure of terrible majesty, addressing his shattered army with such rhetorical brilliance, you almost forget he's the villain. Yet Milton reveals the cracks. Approaching Eden, devastating self-awareness breaks through. Which way I fly is hell. Myself am hell. His punishment isn't external fire. It's the prison of his own corrupted nature. Glimpsing Adam and Eve's innocent happiness, he's briefly, stupidly good, disarmed by their beauty before hatred resurges. His arc traces a tragic descent from brightest angel to literal snake. By poem's end, his apparent triumph becomes hollow as he and his followers transform into serpents, eternally reaching for fruit that turns to ash. Pride doesn't just destroy Satan, it reduces him from sublime to pathetic, a warning about how resentment consumes even the most brilliant minds. Milton's paradise surpasses all mythical gardens. Trees bear blooming ambrosial fruit, brooks run with nectar, and roses bloom without thorns. At its center stand Adam and Eve, godlike erect, with native honor clad in naked majesty. Their nakedness signifies innocence. They feel no shame because they know no sin. Their relationship reveals both 17th century limitations and genuine appreciation for marital love. Eve is created for sweet, attractive grace, Adam for contemplation, a hierarchy modern readers might question. Yet their bond contains real tenderness. Eve awakens beside a lake, falling in love with her reflection until a voice leads her to Adam. Though she initially found him less fair, she discovers deeper connection when he calls her, "Part of my soul, I seek thee, and thee claim my other half." Their days combine pleasant labor with spiritual devotion. They tend the garden, pruning excess growth, supporting climbing plants, work that satisfies rather than exhausts. Milton celebrates their physical union as the perpetual fountain of domestic sweets, portraying married love as sacred. This Eden represents not just what humanity lost, but what we still yearn for: harmony with nature, each other, and something greater than ourselves. From his throne, God watches Satan approach Eden with perfect foreknowledge of what will unfold. This creates Milton's central challenge. If God knows Adam and Eve will fall, why allow it? His answer establishes the poem's core theme. I made him just and right, sufficient to have stood, though free to fall. Divine foreknowledge doesn't negate human choice. Knowing what someone will choose isn't the same as forcing that choice. This philosophical position lets Milton justify the ways of God to men by presenting the fall as consequence of freedom rather than divine cruelty. When God declares that humanity's redemption requires someone able and as willing to pay sin's price, the Son volunteers, "Behold me then, me for him, life for life." Milton populates heaven with distinct personalities. Raphael visits Adam as friendly instructor, warning against Satan's temptations. Most memorable is Abdiel, who alone among Satan's legions remains faithful. Faithful found among the faithless, faithful only he. His solitary stand against overwhelming peer pressure exemplifies moral courage when rebellion seems popular.
Satan's strategy reveals sophisticated psychology. Finding humanity's single prohibition, the tree of knowledge, he exalts, "O fair foundation laid whereon to build their ruin." The pivotal moment comes when Eve suggests working separately. Adam resists, but Eve argues untested virtue has little value, unknowingly echoing Satan's own reasoning. Possessing a serpent, Satan approaches with calculated flattery, then lies that eating forbidden fruit granted him reason. He questions God's prohibition, suggesting God withholds knowledge to keep humans subservient. "Your eyes shall be opened, and ye shall be as gods." Eve's reasoning reveals how temptation works through self-justification. She gazes at the fruit, questions why knowledge should be forbidden, convinces herself death cannot follow since the serpent ate and lives. With rationalization complete, her rash hand in evil hour forth reaching to the fruit she plucked, she ate. Adam's choice differs. Not deceived, but fondly overcome with female charm, he eats knowingly, preferring death with Eve to life without her. His sin is love twisted into idolatry, placing his wife above his creator, a reminder that even noble feelings can lead us astray when they eclipse reason and conscience. The aftermath reveals Adam and Eve transformed, their eyes opened but minds darkened. Shame becomes their first emotion as they fashion fig leaf coverings, poor substitutes for lost innocence. More devastating is their fractured union. Where harmony reigned, bitter accusations fly. Adam blames Eve for wandering. Eve retorts he should have stopped her. This pattern echoes every dissolving partnership, how conflict makes us forget shared responsibility and scramble to protect our righteousness. God's judgment comes not as immediate death, but as consequences fundamentally altering existence. The serpent crawls on its belly, Eve bears children in pain, Adam labors against thorns until returning to dust. Though death is pronounced, it's delayed, and the sun compassionately clothes them with animal skins. The natural world itself disrupts. Angels tilt Earth's axis, bringing harsh seasons where perpetual spring once reigned. Sin and death build a bridge from hell to earth. Adam's response evolves from despair to acceptance, gradually recognizing mercy in judgment, particularly the promise that Eve's seed shall bruise the serpent's head, the first glimmer of hope in their darkened world. Before expulsion, Michael grants Adam prophetic visions of humanity's future. The brutal opening, Cain murdering Abel, introduces Adam to death. Further scenes reveal disease, violence, and the flood. Adam weeps, but learns these disasters spring from sin's destructiveness, not divine cruelty. The post-flood world shows little improvement. Nimrod's tyranny, Babel's tower, where technological advancement perverts into pride. Yet amid darkness, God selects Abraham, establishing a covenant preserving truth through generations. The visions trace Israel's history, Egyptian slavery, Mosaic liberation, Sinai's law, Davidic kingship, all prefiguring the Messiah who will crush the serpent's head. The climax reveals Christ's incarnation, crucifixion, and resurrection. Michael explains Christ defeats Satan not through combat, but through perfect obedience and sacrificial death, victory through apparent defeat, strength through vulnerability, life through death. Adam responds with profound wonder, realizing suffering for truth's sake is fortitude to highest victory, and death becomes the gate of life. These insights mark his spiritual maturation, movement from innocence through painful experience to deeper wisdom. The poem ends with Adam and Eve departing Eden hand in hand, facing the world all before them. They've lost paradise, but gained something profound. Wisdom born from failure proves more valuable than untested purity.